Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everybody. Good morning. Welcome to Behind the Blue Curtain. I'm your host, Stan Mason, and we're about to get started. And let's get it going.
Mostly I'm tired of people being ugly to each other. I'm tired of all the pain I feel and hear in the world every day. There's too much of it. It's like pieces of glass in my head all the time. Can you understand?
We've now received the dash cam video from this incident. This is what happened leading up to the killing of Walter Scott. Let's watch it.
We've also learned that another Cleveland officer took his own life last night. 39-year-old patrol officer Nicholas Sabo shot himself.
Word that there will be no federal charges against Baltimore police officers in the death of Freddie Gray. Gray was arrested in 2015 for having a switchblade, dying after bouncing around in the back of a police van.
As the body of Officer Jim Daly was escorted to the Cook County Medical Examiner's Office for an autopsy, questions surround his untimely death. Sources tell the Chicago Tribune that Officer Daly's body was found in the locker room at the 19th District Police Station in the 800 block of West Addison Street in Lakeview.
Two Cleveland police officers will not face federal charges in the shooting death of 12-year-old Tamir Rice, an encounter that helped galvanize the Black Lives Matter movement.
Good evening. For the second time in as many weeks, a grand jury has found the evidence is just not there to charge a white police officer in connection with the death of a black civilian.
In Charlotte, North Carolina, a man involved in a car accident over the weekend went looking for help and wound up dead. He was shot again and again by a police officer who is now facing criminal charges.
911.
I need a deputy to come to my house.
What's going on?
My husband has committed suicide.
October 2016, Heidi Harper returning home from EMT training.
I don't know. I came home and he's sitting in the garage. I can't touch him on my phone. I can't go in there. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
David's wife, Melissa, says he always treated people with respect.
Hey, little buddies.
He loved animals and would do anything for his four kids.
He would have to work, like, night shifts so he could take us to school.
But 3 years ago, it was the kids who told Melissa something wasn't right with Dad. Later that week, they were supposed to go to Disneyland on their youngest boy's second birthday, but David had locked himself in a bathroom.
I looked down and I found him. I'm so sorry. I just still don't understand how we went from planning to go to Disneyland for dinner. We're having to plan a funeral.
The jury in the above entitled matter as to count one, unintentional second degree murder while committing a felony, find the defendant guilty. This verdict agreed to this 20th day of April 2021 at 1:44 p.m.
All right, everybody, good morning. Again, welcome to Behind the Blue Curtain. I'm your host, Stan Mason. Of course, we got everybody up in the house. Big John is moving around. And what I wanted to do this week, in all the confusion and the hysteria and the mania and the celebration and on the Chauvin conviction, is talk about police reform. But I want to do it, and Stan's perspective is, police reform to me is not everything for the citizens, nothing for the police. Because police officers are citizens. And I know a lot of officers that work the streets, and that's where I was in the streets. They want reform. They're fighting. They want it as much as some of the citizens want it. It'll make their job a lot easier and probably cut down on a lot of the suicides, you know, that we see out here. Nothing's happening with it. And some of these are friends and comrades, and some of these people committing suicide, I don't know them personally, but I've been to those calls and I've been to those situations. And for those of you that are tuning in the first time to the show and you're trying to figure out what they are, this is not a Black Lives Matter show. a Blue Lives Matter show, a Republican or Democrat show. It's not a Christian show, a Muslim show. On this show, we're real. On this show, the voice of the least, if you want to call in and chime in and add, the number is 646-716-4621. You don't have to sound smart. You don't have to be the most intelligent person in the room, because Lord knows I'm not. We're not MSNBC. We're not Fox. We're not CNN. But everything that you see here, we do on our time and our money. And you know, we've got my personal opinion. I'm blessed to have these people around me, you know, top left, and I'll let them introduce themselves. You know, I got a 32-year homicide detective from Chicago. If this is a stand show, it's his show. To the right, as I look at my screen, or to my left, as you all look, to me, I've got the most courageous police chief in this country. The only one with enough guts to be here every week. Not just when the show is about him. Jim Devlin, and he'll introduce himself. Underneath me on my right, Isidora Rodriguez, investigative journalist, not blogger, not Facebook warrior, an investigative journalist. And then that screen at my bottom left that you see just kind of moving around, and that's John Ruffin. And John is also a co-host on the show.
Me.
And I'll let John introduce himself, but we'll get jump into it. Before I go, I've got to say what's up, Waco, on Facebook. I mean, I love my people in Waco. That's second home to me. What's up, Harrisburg, Pennsylvania? And I'm currently in the ATL. And congratulations, Reverend Frank Montgomery in Waco. And I'll be there tomorrow. And let's go up. Big Joe, good morning. What's going on? How was your week?
Always great. Always a great week. I shared some stuff with you guys during the week, and we'll get into that. Just one heck of a week, again, looking at all the social media posts. We got a problem, people. We got to fix it. But let me jump into something real quick. One of the problems I find, particularly when we talk about police reform, is how do we get these people to learn what management is? I mean, certainly, if we took a page out of Jim Devlin's playbook, he would be the pin for what the manager should be. Just because you're promoted does not mean you're in a position to command and lead. And with that, I'll leave it alone.
All right. What's up, Chief? How are you this morning?
Very good. Very good. Started off early, you know, did the old soccer game with the kiddos. So, you know, have to be here. It has been a heck of a week. Just like what Joe's saying, some of that social media stuff we got going on, there's a disconnect, I think, in certain instances about this job, you know, and how do we get from get rid of all the police, the funding, to what we really need, which is going to be the compromise in the middle. You know, I've got my ideas. Hopefully we can share some of that stuff today. And you know, the thing is, it's not too hard to look. There are places that are doing it right. So, you know, not every place is screwed up, but just happy to get going today.
Amen, brother. What's up, Ed?
Hey, all. Happy to be here. Ready to get into it because, yeah, it's been a rough week. It's one thing after another. And for me, from my end, on the media side of things, it's just frustrating to see the narrative being pushed as this canyon between these two opposing sides. You got the pro-police sort of portrayed as these dogmatic supporters, and then on the other side you have your, you know, apparently everybody just wants to abolish the police. And it's frustrating because the key to success of achieving reform and achieving change is cohesion and people working together, and not people. The more we fight and argue about what needs to change or how it needs to change it, the less we get done. And at certain points, it almost seems like it's on purpose. But, yeah, hopefully we'll talk about that today as well.
All right, Big John, good morning. How are you?
Good
morning, good morning. I apologize to everyone. I'm on the road. I just want to say, man, we've been talking about remedies. We've been talking about problems. I hope today that we can talk, start to begin the conversation of action. And how do we get here? So I hope we can get past just talking about problems today. I hope we can get past just talking about a remedy, and let's get talking about action. What we need to do and how we need to do it. Peace.
All right, brothers. I'm going to start this call out with the gentleman I actually met probably 30 minutes ago through another friend, Sean Riley. That police officer, incredible testimony that I felt was great to hear. And Sean Freeway, and I asked him just spur the moment. He doesn't know jack about me. And we talked very briefly, and I said, "Would you come on and just share your story?" And he agreed to do it. So I'm going to ask Brandon, are you there?
Yes, Sam. I'm here. Sam, I'm here.
Good morning, brother. You're on. Would you? Yes, sir. We can hear you. Would you share your story?
Yes, sir. I want to thank you just for the opportunity to come on this morning. And me and my wife are actually on the road coming back from West Virginia, heading back to South Carolina. But you know, we did talk briefly this morning, and again, I just, man, thank you for the opportunity to come on and you know, just to share our story. Me and my wife are you know, both strong in our faith. Our faith plays a tremendous part in our walk every day and the way we live. I'm a 20-year deputy sheriff, retired in September, began my career on patrol, and feel like now, looking back at my career, I missed a lot of opportunities. And it's amazing that, you know, one of the big things that I think law enforcement's missing today is the ability to have empathy and for law enforcement officers to put themselves in the shoes of the people that we deal with on a day-to-day basis. And obviously, looking back at my career, I know that I was only one mistake away, you know, from being in the same position as the guy that was sitting in the back seat of my patrol car at the time. And, you know, so I took that in the latter part of my career and began trying to show that on a day-to-day basis, put myself in the shoes of the people that I was dealing with. And, you know, how could I make a positive difference instead of, you know, you have two choices. I can either be a butt to these people, be a jerk and just take them straight to jail, or I can try to empathize with them. I can try to talk with them. I can try to reach them when they're at the bottom of their bottom. You know, so that was one of the things that, you know, we talked about early in our career. I went through a critical incident in 2011. I was working narcotics. I was involved in an armed robbery in a restaurant that we were sitting in eating. We exchanged gunfire with the young man, 17 years old at the time, had a drug issue, came in the restaurant just trying to get money to get his next high. And so I ended up being shot in that incident, took a 357 round through and through upper torso, very fortunate and blessed not to have any critical injuries. I was shot on a Thursday night, got out of the hospital on a Monday morning. Again, that incident changed a lot in the way that I looked at things, even more so when you realize how much as a police officer we pour into our jobs. How much time we spend away from our families. And I had over 400 hours of vacation time the night that I got shot. And you know, looking back, I think, you know, okay, well, if I would have died that night, that's 400 hours of my life that I gave to an agency that was great. My agency was fantastic during my shooting. And, you know, we have a pretty progressive agency that I worked for. That our sheriff backed us, our sheriff stood for us, you know, which I think is something else that a lot of agencies lack. You know, we spoke briefly about this earlier, you know, but when you've got sheriffs that are, you know, falling to and under the control of, you know, a city manager or a county council that doesn't support, you know, that says, hey, you better handle this the right way, instead of handling it the way that a sheriff should and backing his officers from the get-go. You know, am I saying that every situation that's portrayed now is correct? No. You know, I talk to a lot of people and I tell them, you know, you look at some of these incidents now that are national news, and, you know, the people that are most maddest about the way things are handled sometimes are the police officers out there that go, you know, dude, that was wrong. You know, that shouldn't have been handled that way. You know better. I know you were trained better. And again, as a police trainer for the last 8 years, you know, it's one of those things you go, come on, man, you got to do better than that. You've got to see that's not the way we should have handled that. And, you know, I told Sean, you know, last night, the last year of my career, I spent working in our detention center. 2017, our oldest son came to us and, you know, again, you know, 18-year police veteran. And my son comes to us and says, hey, I'm addicted to heroin. And you talk about a kick in the gut, you know, you're a police officer that's fought the drug trade on the street for 2 years of your life. And, you know, in a career police officer that says, you know, hey, we've got to get this stuff off the street. And then your son's tied into it. And, you know, you go, okay, where did I go wrong? What did I miss? You know, so we battled through that and through the grace of God, he's clean and been clean since July the 14th of 2019. Is married. We've got a grandchild. I am coming up on a toll road. Hold on just a second. I'm sorry, Stan. We like I said, we're traveling, and I've got to pay my toll, and they're going to call the police on me. So. Thank you.
Don't worry about it, brother. This story is worth the wait.
All right, I'm through the toll road now. So, you know, but like I said, through the grace of God, we got through his addiction. You know, and again, I didn't know how God was going to use, you know, all of my experiences through my career, you know, with my shooting, being shot, you know, as a, you know, we talked about race a little bit earlier. And as a white police officer, you know, that was shot by a young black male, you know, it was one of those things that, you know, for me, I never said, okay, well, what color was the guy that shot me? You know, his mom stood in court and said, you know, I didn't raise my son this way. You know, I don't want you to hate me. I don't want you to hate my son for what he did to you in this incident. And Stan, it was one of the most freeing things for me and my wife. You know, I was able to stand in the courtroom the day that my suspect was sentenced, and I was able to stand there and tell him that I forgave him. And we were able to walk out of that courtroom and find his mama. And Stan, we were able to talk to his mama and say, you know, look, we don't hold anything against you. You know, this world that we live in is fallen. You know, our world's full of sin. Our world is full of darkness, and things happen. You know, I said, I have no doubt that you didn't raise your son to go into a restaurant and rob it and shoot a police officer. I have no doubt about that. And you know, we were able to hug her, and we both just stood there and cried, me and my wife and his mom. You know, so when you start talking about reform and police, you have to start looking at police officers making a difference, police officers being able to see and look through, you know, the Bible tells us and the world tells us, you know, we've got to be the hands and feet of Jesus. Well, I think also we have to have the eyes of Jesus. We have to be able to look at the people that we deal with on a day-to-day basis the same way that God looks at us. You know, because I have my own darkness in my heart and in my mind that I have to deal with on a day-to-day basis. And if I condemn the people that I deal with on a day-to-day basis, then what good am I doing? You know, because what if God condemned me the same way and said, you're not worth trying to save? You're not worth fighting for. You're not worth me sending my son to sacrifice for you. You know, so I think that when we start looking at people in that way, then we can start changing the way the world views things. And we start looking at people and saying, okay, well, you know, well, this police officer didn't do this because he's white. This person didn't do this crime because they're black. They're doing these things because we live in a fallen world. And until we start looking at things in that way and start realizing that it's not, like you said earlier when we talked on the phone, it's not a black or white thing. It's not a Hispanic thing. It's not a, you know, it's not a race thing. It's a heart issue from the get-go on everything that we deal with. So when I walked into the jail, I walked in with that mentality of, okay, how can I walk into a jail with 170 inmates and start changing hearts? How can I be something different in this place? You know, I had an opportunity to speak at the National Law Enforcement Retreat for Billy Graham, and I challenged officers at the end of my speech to go back to their departments and be something different, be a light. You know, offer hope to people that are in the back of your patrol car when they may be at the most hopeless point that they ever been. You know, I talk about police suicide and, you know, being in this career for 20 years, I don't understand, and I don't understand how officers make it through 20, 25-year careers, seeing the things that we see on a day-to-day basis and not have a hope that at the end of all of this, things are going to be different. You know, that this fight's already been won, and, you know, we have to deal through these dark days, but at the end of the day, there's going to be something different. You know, so I shared with Sean last night, you know, we're a big part of a addiction ministry called Ground 40 in Monroe, North Carolina. And, you know, it's a biblical and spiritual-based discipleship rehabilitation off of, you know, addiction, whether that be to, you know, pornography, drug addiction, alcohol, whatever the case may be, to bring men back to a biblical standpoint of where they're called to be and put them back in their families, to put them back in society, to society as productive citizens. So part of that was going into the jail. I wanted those guys to come into my jail and say, you know, look, let's minister to the guys in our jail. Let's give them a hope. Let's give them an out. To know that, you know, when you walk out of this jail, there's a place and there's an opportunity for you to be something different than what your mind and what your neighborhood may be telling you that you've got to be. You know, so we were able to come in. We were able to bring these guys in. We handpicked. I prayed through and handpicked some of the first few guys that came into the program.
Uh-oh, we lose you. All right, hopefully we'll get it back. Joe, you heard about
some of our...
Okay.
Sir?
Yeah, no, go ahead, brother. We lost you for a second, but we got
some of... Okay, I'm sorry. Like I said, I'm in the mountains and coming back through. So, but some of our most hardened criminals that would stop us on the way out and go, you know, hey, who are these guys and what are they doing? I said, well, man, they're an addiction ministry and they're just in here trying to share the gospel and trying to make a difference in the lives of people. Well, I want to talk to them. And I showed Sean a video last night that we're able to, you know, stand on our private hallway in this, you know, concrete jail. And one of the guys brought a guitar in and was sharing, you know, contemporary Christian music, playing a guitar in the hall, singing. And you know, and I told Sean, I said, you know, our jail was normally pretty loud, banging on the doors, cussing, yelling, screaming, you know, but on those nights, there was just a peace there in the jail. And, you know, and it's amazing to see. It's amazing to watch the attitudes change. It was amazing for me to be able to go in and make that difference. I don't attribute that to me. I attribute that to me trying to live my life in a way that honors God and to make a difference in the lives of those guys. And I told Sean, you know, we were able to get two or three of those guys into Ground 40 when they left the jail. And those guys, one of them yesterday was his one-year mark of being at Ground 40. And he is a senior disciple. He's actually pouring into guys that are coming out of jail now and trying to help them to see that they can break the cycle. You know, you know, again, I appreciate you letting me come on. You know, man, I just think that, you know, when we start talking about police reform, training, you know, we've been training police officers for years and years and years. You know, you can get out into your neighborhood and try to change, you know, with community policing of getting out and saying, you know, hey, get out of your car, talk to people. You know, but if I get out with a hard heart to talk to somebody, or I just sit on somebody's front porch with a hard heart and I'm not willing to listen and empathize with them and say, you know, hey, look, tell me about your life. Tell me what's going on. Tell me what I can do as a police officer on the street to mm-hmm. change, you know, the dynamic for you and your neighborhood. You know, mm-hmm. to get out and meet these young folks where they are and shed a different light on things. You know, that's where we're going to make a difference. You know, when we change the hearts of the people on the street, when we change the hearts of police officers riding in cars all day and make it, you know, hey, let me get out and make a true difference in my community. I think that's where we're going to see true reform.
Amen, brother. Well, look here, man, I appreciate you being here, and you got my number. I sent both of them to you. You got the show number, but you got mine. Because I want to get you on with the chief and Joe, and you know, one day when we get some time, we can all sit down, because you're doing some amazing things there that, you know, the media is not going to jump on because it's productive and it doesn't produce ratings for them. But I appreciate you taking time out, especially short notice, to be here and share your story, man. I appreciate that.
Absolutely, Stan. Thank you again, sir.
All right, brother. Y'all travel safe.
Thank you.
Yes, sir. All right, Joe. He covered a lot. And you got more time out there than I have.
Well, it's interesting because he hit on a bunch of issues that I think are very germane to this situation. I think if we start at the top, what I started off saying was, and I still maintain, that if you look at Jim Devlin and use him as a model, you'll find that the top-down approach does work. Most agencies are not willing to do that. Other problem you have is that, again, Jim Devlin empowers his officers to do things. As you know, I'm back to work, and my group, I've empowered them, and they've done, in less than a month, they've done some miraculous things because they are empowered. They have the ability to make a decision. And what happens is, and it goes, it actually relates to what we've been talking about also. It also relates to how police react to certain situations. And this is what I mean. We've taken the power of discretion out of their playbook. We've also made these guys automaton. So we've talked about it before. If you look at the recent state stabbing shootings by the police, they're all automatic responses. And what I mean is this. Rather than go to what we talk about, soft hand, they go to a baton or less than lethal because they're taught less than lethal as opposed to learning how to speak to people. And if they got some of those situations, could they have been diffused? Could they have possibly been diffused by just taking a few more seconds to say something as opposed to nothing? As opposed to saying, hey, motherfucker, how about, hey, man, let me talk to you. Or, I mean, you give him a point. The other problem I have is, again, for me, I've seen it. Wrong people get promoted.
Absolutely.
Let's talk about that. We want to talk about reform. Reform the promotional process.
Mm-hmm.
Because just as anyone on this panel will tell you, those teams become a reflection of their leadership. What did the DOJ talk about? Every report, leadership. What's the first line of leadership? That sergeant. So if you got a fucked up sergeant, you got a fucked up team. Pardon my language.
Woo, okay. Well, Izzy, we're going to drop down to you. Come on. We're going to get you ready. Did you get, first off, did you have your coffee this morning?
What do you think this is? Batman coffee.
Okay, brother, come on.
I mean, I've always agreed with everything that Joe said, and I took some notes in terms of what the former chief said and in terms of terms of his description of the job and everything, and I tip my hat to everything that he did. There's just some, there's some interesting points that he talked about. He had 400 plus hours of vacation time to him that he never took, right? Or days?
Mm-hmm. Or hours?
Hours. I understand it as a leader, as a chief, and you've got to make sacrifices, and police officers make sacrifices and stuff. But when we're talking about things like officer wellness, like, we need to start changing some things around, because it shouldn't be allowed for a police officer to have that much accrued vacation time and not taking it. There should be things in place that would be like, yo, you have vacation time coming up to you. You have to take it. Why? Because it's better for your mental health. You'll be able to relax, and when you come back to the job, you'll be fresher, you'll be more...
Is he faded out again?
What happened in Brooklyn?
Brooklyn Wi-Fi.
You still there?
It happened again, I'm telling you.
Yep.
Like, the Wi-Fi here, everybody's on it. So like I said, they shouldn't be allowed to take that much time off. We need to have systems in place that are acknowledging and looking at the effects that this job has on the people that are doing it. And it should be, no, you have to take time off. You have to go take a vacation. The fact that you're accruing that amount of time, like, there's too much. And I remember, like, I worked in restaurants, which is hardly comparable, but it was the same thing. They get you to work longer hours because there was this weird honor or pride you got from doing work harder and longer than the other person. And that pat on the back and that, like, hey, man, you're good. We can rely on you to work longer and harder than everybody else. Like, you start thinking that that's better than pay, that's better than vacation time. But then it comes back around because by the time you're done, you're exhausted, you're stressed, you're worse at your job. And those same managers that didn't tell you to take a vacation come to you and say, yo, what's wrong? Why are you freaking out? Why are you having all these problems? It's because you're not taking time off. It's because you're not taking self-care into consideration. And I think in policing, definitely, that was just for restaurant workers. I mean, if you saw me after doing like 4 back-to-back doubles and you got me on the wrong brunch, you do not want me waiting on you. And I don't have a gun in the badge. What is going to happen to these people that are doing multiple overtime, that aren't taking vacation, that aren't considering self-care and self-wellness? But have that part of the conversation. It needs to be roped in because this job has an effect on me, and it wears you down.
Let me say this about that issue. Now, my uncle did 30-plus years in Chicago, father too. When my uncle left, he had over 4,000 hours on the books. 4,000. But now, he died within 3 years of leaving the job because actuarial numbers say that police officers, and you can check it, will die in the first 3 years. And what you said hits the point perfectly. The fact of the matter is that our systems don't reward good work. Let me just put it like that.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens is people take and they what we call banking the hours. Tell me if I'm wrong, guys. Don't we bank the hours?
Mm-hmm.
Because it's a form of a, lack of a better term, I can get more money at the end. So what you do is you don't put in the overtime. You take the time.
Yeah, but Joe, if I can real quick before I go to a caller and then go to the chief, you know, I think that's important, and I agree with what Izzy said. But I think, and I'm just speaking for me, that for some officers who do empathize and are in some of these tough communities who can identify with these people, who can identify with their living conditions, who can identify with the fact that they're dealing with gentrification and everything else is being done on a political and economic level far beyond them. You go in there and you're dealing with these people and they're going into their refrigerator giving you the only bottle of water they got in the house. And you connect with them. And some days you say, I really want to take vacation. But when people tell you, the only time my kids come out and play is when you're working. You know, and you're in this because your heart is in the right place, you start carrying that cross. And yes, it takes a psychological toll on you, but at the same time where maybe you're not going to Disney World with your kids that you're sending because you worked overtime. Maybe you're not going to SeaWorld. But, you know, you're also not reading about this little kid or this teenager that's dead in a drive-by, or you're not having to come to work and hear somebody died in your area on your day off. And I know for me, I missed a lot of my kids' life. I missed a lot of the vacations and all that. I missed a lot of it. I would not trade a thing, because some of the kids walking around Waco today are alive, not because of Stan, but just maybe because I was there. And I think that when you retire and you look in that mirror and you sit at night and you think and you look over your career, being able to say, I played the game the right way. I did it the right way. I didn't put anybody in jail. That really, to me, is my therapy. That really keeps me saying, let me grab this caller, Chief, and then I'm going to go to you, 804 area code 8603. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, man. It's Big Gus. It's Big Gus in the 804. How y'all doing, family? I want to say, I don't know if that deputy is, I'm good. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we got you.
Okay, good. I want to say to that deputy, man, is thank him for his service, man. He has a positive outlook on the community that he had served. And I think that if we had more officers like that, it probably would be a better place. It would be a better place. Kudos to that officer. But, I mean, Stan, reform starts, man. You have to have reform on both sides. I mean, you got to give the police officers, something to work with, but you also got to hold them accountable when they do misdeeds, too, and misconduct. Now, I'm glad that they're talking about, on the news, on all the stations, they're talking about doing a national registry for police officers who have been charged or have a bunch of misconduct allegations or disciplinary problems. I think that's a good start, because you got to weed the ones who aren't doing any good to the community. I know some of them think that their jobs is just law enforcement, but just like the gentleman just said, you have to engage in your community, man, to make it safe for everybody. Now, if you got an officer driving through and he only comes through your neighborhood because he's at work and doesn't know anybody, what good is it doing for the people who are coming up, who are vulnerable and straddling the fence on whether they want to do a life of crime or get into trouble or see something positive in their neighborhood? So, I mean, of course, we need police officers, but I think the reform starts – we need reform on both sides so they can do a respectable and a productive job in the community.
Amen, brother. I'll tell you, Gus, it's good to hear your voice again, bro. It's like a blast from the past, man. It's good to hear you. I hope everything's well up there.
It is, man. It is. The political season started again, and Terry McAuliffe is running for governor again, though. It's a big mess, so we'll talk about that some other time.
All right, brother. We appreciate you. 323 caller, I see you. We'll get you in a minute, but I got to get my Chief in here. Come on, Chief. I see you. You was binging it. I know you ready.
Well, I mean, all of it's true. Specifically, you know, a couple points. You know, the deputy talking about the empathy. I mean, that's extremely important, I think, in this business. And looking at – and what he said is true. And I fell into the same category early on. I could have been one mistake being, you know, away from the person in the back of my car. And you have to realize some of their circumstances. Now, again, we're confined in a box in law enforcement. There are certain things, you know, that there are laws, there are things that we can have discretion on. There's some things we don't have discretion on. I mean, there's certainly, you know, that's not written by me. I didn't make that law. But there's some things that tell me on a particular family violence situation. You know, if one spouse strikes another, you're going to jail. I have no choice. You're going to jail. But, you know, small amounts of narcotics. You know, I'm going to be honest. I'll tell you, early on in my career, and I could have done a bunch of possession under two under Texas law, Class B misdemeanors. I think I dumped more of that out. I'm surprised my former community didn't have marijuana growing everywhere. But let's I always use it like as the term of the godfather. I'm cutting you some slack, but now you owe me a favor.
Mm-hmm.
So when there was the homicide, or there was the armed robbery, or there was that major felony that took place, guess where I went? Hey, you remember I cut you that slack? What do we know about this? Why don't you point me in a direction? And it worked that way early on in my career. And realized that not everybody was in the same status as I was. You know, there are people, just like you said, their last bottle of water from the refrigerator, they're trying to get it to you. You know, and they got nothing. And so, you know, it changed my perspective on how this job needs to be. Taking that forward out now as a boss, I pushed that. You know, ultimately, at the end of the day, I'm the one responsible for whatever happens in my community. The council members, my city manager, they're not calling the officer. They're going to call me. I mean, I was on the phone yesterday, 6 p.m., dealing with a code enforcement issue. The chief of police dealing with a code enforcement issue. But I dealt with it because it's important to somebody in the community. So we did what we needed to do, take care of the issue, got remedy. And the other part I want to talk about is what Gus just said. That accountability is on both sides. I mean, when we start talking about being accountable, and there may be people that don't want to hear that, but you know what? I hold my people accountable. When they mess up, they pay the price. When they do well, they get accolades. But you know, that's a two-way street. You know, we need to have this conversation about what it means to be accountable. For me, it's easy. I can tell you what accountability for officers is. This other conversation about the other side of accountability is where we need to sit down with the community and find out what's responsive to the community. What does the community want from us? What do they want us to do? And that's part of that whole vague concept. I say vague because when we use the term community policing is different for every community. You know, it's not a one fit size fits all everything. My community policing for my community is not going to work in Chicago. It might. There may be some things there, but there's probably way bigger problems that they've got going on than I've got. As a matter of fact, I know there are bigger problems than what I've got going on. So, you know, you have to style it with input from the people that are in your city. And again, something that Gus said, if the only time you drive down that street because you're at work, that doesn't cut it. I mean, this is the first community that I've ever policed in that I actually live in that I police. But you know, it's not any different than where I was at. When I go to the store, when I'm out in the community, when I'm doing things, people know who I am. You know, I'm not in uniform. Obviously, I'm not wearing my uniform today. But you know, I got to talk to today that people know who I am. I was in Waco at a soccer field, and somebody came up, "Hey, chief, how you doing?" "Man, good, man. How are you?" So you know, it's being responsive, being out there. And it's tough, and I'm going to say this to the law enforcement leaders that are out there. It's a 24/7 job. If you think it's get a good command staff and put them in place and let the my command staff handles a lot. They handle quite a bit because I put a lot of responsibility on them. And just like Joe said, I empower my people to make these decisions and get things done. But you know, I work more now as a chief than I did as an officer. And I was that guy that had 400. Well, I didn't have 400 hours, but I had 200 something hours of vacation. And it took me a long time to realize that that's not good. And what Izzy said is spot on. We need to start dealing from the internal side on the officer wellness. I mean, not only mentally. What are you doing? Taking pictures.
Two phones. You know what I mean? You got bingo.
So what Izzy's saying is correct. Officer wellness, so the internal side, let's talk about it from the law enforcement perspective and reform. Fatigue plays a huge problem. Fatigue is a major issue in law enforcement. When they're working these overtime gigs and they're working 18, 19, 20 hours a day, nobody can sustain that. Nobody can sustain it. It just doesn't matter. Then dealing with the calls for service, the potential and or actual PTSD that officers get, the continuous beating and beratement or you know, just having to see the worst of the worst. We know scientifically that has an effect on the brain. I think Izzy would certainly back that up. That's a major issue. And then you get into the physical wellness, you know, calcium screenings, heart attacks, you know, Joe's done for about 3 years is pretty spot. Last time I ever looked at the officer life expectancy after retirement was 5 years. And so not doing enough in our agencies to get people off. But Stan, again, I'm going to go back and say there's that caveat. because of some of the personality, the way that we're made up. When somebody in the community tells them, it tells you, well, you know, we feel safe when you're here and you're around, that makes you want to be there. I mean, I wanted to be there. I wanted to be there to make a difference and catch the bad guys and do the things. I'm talking about bad guys, not people with the registration out. I'm talking about armed robbers and killers. I mean, I want to be there to get those folks, you know, and the major dope dealers. You know, I'm not talking 2 ounces of weed. I'm talking about 25 keys of coke. You know, that's what I want.
Right.
And make that difference in that community, and we have a lot of people around that do this, and there are good agencies in this country. There are some bad agencies in this country. I mean, if we were all perfect, we wouldn't be on the news. But the biggest thing is connecting with the community. And if you're on, and please don't take this wrong, but if your idea of reform for law enforcement is commenting on social media, then you're doing it wrong. You need to get up and go to your local governments or your county or whatever and get involved in the situation. You want to come to you and find out, I've got Citizens Police Academy's coffees with the cop. You have more opportunities to come talk to me and come find me in the grocery store. Tell me what you want to tell me. I'm there. I'm willing to listen. So, you know, it's that responsiveness from law enforcement, I think, that we need. And you know, Joe, I appreciate the page out of Jim Devlin's book, but I'm not anybody special. I'm not. I've learned a lot of lessons in this job. I've failed a lot. I have failed a lot, but I've learned from all that. I've got good people. I've got really good people around me that make my community a safe community, make one that I think that people want to be part of. Now, are there people here that don't like us? Sure. I mean, there's some people that don't like us. But we do what we can to try to reach those individuals. And what I found is people that don't like us, but they do find me. Well, I have a conversation with them. There's very few that leave not liking us anymore. I mean, it's about that communication and that respect, you know, and that's kind of what it boils down to. Just rambling, but, man, I tell you what, it's just getting out and engaging with those people. You know, I tell my officers, team people that I train, and drive down the street, you have somebody out there mowing their yard or gardening, stop and talk to them. Or they're watering the grass.
But isn't that a common sense approach to police?
It is it's an absolute 100% common sense approach.
But here's the other thing that's interesting. If you look at one of the things about pushing these hours for police officers, is it makes them prone to corruption. So let's call it what it is. I mean, I know of shifts where they're running 12-hour shifts with three men.
Right.
In the world, where did you get that from? So what do you think is going to happen? So they go, I mean, just based on that, three men, 12-hour shift, what do you think is going to happen?
Right.
So are they going to be prone not only to being tired, they'll be slow in their reaction? Are they going to make mistakes? I would probably venture a guess, yes.
Yeah, you know, that's a government issue. I mean, and we talk about, again, I can go on, and I mean, I know we're talking about their reform, but police officer pay. I mean, I don't have the studies, and I don't know, but in my particular area, not that I'm advocating for any more dollars, but
you are
a significant difference between North Texas, the Dallas-Fort Worth area, the Austin area, which is pretty comparable, and in Houston, and Central Texas, where Stan used to work, and I'm currently at. There's a big difference in that compensation package. And so, yeah, and again, from a leader perspective, Stan's agency, Waco, is the biggest agency here outside the Sheriff's Department. I'm competing for the same people. I fight for the same good officers that his agency's trying to pick up from. So it's a competitive issue. Yeah, well, you know what? I win most of the time. Now, they steal some from me, and that's fine, but I win.
You know, Chief,
based on a lot of stuff. But, you know, it's a fight. And so we talk about that compensation and keeping them away from that fatigue. What you're saying, Joe, that's true. There are some communities where, you know, that type of manpower, that type of staffing is not conducive to what we're talking about. It's absolutely anti what we would need. But having the appropriate amount of people there and you know, in the shifts. I mean, I had a conversation with a local chief here further down south for me. A friend of mine I've known for several years came from out of state. And they changed their staffing or their shifts from 12 hours, and he went back to 8. And I said, man, you must be a popular guy. And he said, oh, yeah, they hate me. Ultimately, his goal is to get to 10 because much of the research that's out there finds that 10s are going to be the best shifts for patrol officers, and especially in a very busy environment.
And you save money. A lot of money.
Yeah.
On 10.
A lot of money. And, but you're also talking about, what effective service do you want to bring to that community? I mean, I want my people, I want the best of the best. I've always said that SWAT world, if I was ever taken hostage, I want the best person in the entire world to come in and save me. I don't want the marginalized SWAT operator. I want the best guy to come in and get me. So that's what we need to bring into this conversation is, a lot of these issues internally, and Stan, you've talked about, I don't know how many shows you have done and I've been participated in the officer suicide, but, and again, that's part of the reform issue. I think that's where you were kind of going this morning is that law enforcement leaders need to look at things non-traditional and how we handle our business. And it's things like, psychological testing every year. I mean, I'm going to push that for next budget. Medical screening every year. I'm pushing for that for next budget. Nutritional, and I believe it was Mike Denham said, financial wellness. I mean, you wouldn't believe what cops do. First thing they get their job. They go, well, that, they buy a boat and a car or a truck. And so they've got, $60,000-$70,000 worth of debt and they're making $39,000 a year. So, that's a huge component of financial wellness that becomes a major issue. So, that all that stuff needs to be crammed in. Now, that doesn't have anything to do with these external issues that we're talking about
right
now. But we need to, we need to start pushing that with our people.
That's where
we begin on the inside. And then I think what that does, that helps a lot of the external issues that we're facing.
Before I go to this caller, Chief, I'll insert something, my message to a lot of people thinking about law enforcement. And I get people who, they'll text me or I get a Facebook message, I'm thinking about being a police officer. And I tell them this, that this job is going to be here when you're dead and gone. You're not the savior. You are not going to save and rewrite the city. When you're gone, they'll forget you were ever there. That's the nature of it. I don't care if you're LaDainian Tomlinson when you're leading NFL rusher, but when you leave, the team still plays. And after a while, your fellow friends stop calling. That's the nature of the business. But I say, if you want to be a police officer, you can. What do you want to do in policing? If you want to make a difference in people's lives, if you really want to get in there and understand, then, when you look at your LAPDs and your NYPDs, where you go in the roll call and you're one of 300 people, you're a badge number. You're not an individual. And you're going out into the street with crime that's just mounted up. For me, I was fortunate. I wasn't that wise. When I was led and guided, and I went to Waco. In Waco, I could be a person and make a difference and have an identity. That works for Stan. If you're a statistics hound and you just want to be able to say, I was at this PD, you can go and probably have a good career. But at the end of the most important part of doing this job is at the end of it when you retire. And you really, when the fanfare dies down, Joe, you've been there. You have this mental conversation with yourself. You review that 25 or 30 years, and you say, what have I done? Did I make a difference? How many people you wrote tickets to? How many people you put in jail? That doesn't mean jack. Who did I help? That's a scary conversation to have with yourself. Let me grab this caller real quick, 323 area code 9666. Good morning.
Good morning, Stan. Thanks for having me on the show. This is Rob from Cali again. So
what's up, man?
I want to before I talk about before I give my take, I really kind of feel like I need to preface this a little bit. So I remember I was on Travis's show the other day, and I want people to Travis G. Evans at the point on Tuesday every Tuesday, people don't seem to respond to it, respond to the negative tone of voice that I give to things, because they feel like, well, I'm angry and I have this attitude. I want to also take this time to say that no, I'm not angry. No, I'm not. Well, I'm frustrated, but I want people to understand that, like, this is why I called in last week, Stan, what I'm about to talk about, that at some point, this could be me that we're talking about with police brutality and excessive force and, you know, the over policing basically of black communities. At some point, that it could be me if I don't talk about it. And even if I it's not me, I believe that those that, and I said it too. I said, you know, if it's not me, I represent a lot of young men in this country that just want to exist, that don't want it. No, I'm not prior police. I am prior military, but I'm only talking from the angle of a concerned citizen. And what I see in my community in multiple different cities is you got families that are worried that the police are going to kill them, that the police are going to take their life for doing nothing on top of that. So I want people to understand when you hear me talk about defund the police, you know, when you hear me talk about how we need to attack the police unions' wallets, I'm not saying it just because I want to make police officers angry. I could care less if they're angry, but I'm saying it because it was brought up, oh, accountability needs to be held on both sides. Well, I'm getting tired of hearing only the pro-police side and only hearing that the community needs to do better with parenting, the community needs to do better here, here, and here. It's not that it's wrong, but what I'm saying is that it's not fair to look at the communities and with disparity and say that y'all got to do better. Meanwhile, you're cloaking not you or anybody on this panel specifically, but you're cloaking the very assailants that are you know, they're violating the spirit of what it means to protect and serve, and they don't care. And so with that preface, I want to talk about the Virginia man Isaiah Brown that was shot multiple times on Wednesday, because I want people to understand 10 bullet wounds. This man was at 32 years old. This man was at his home with his family, and 10 bullet wounds after calling the cops. So what I'm trying to get people to understand here is when we say defund the police, we're not saying we don't want police departments. We're saying this is why we need police to quit being the people to respond to those type of calls. Because how in the hell do you have any situation that requires, when you have a person that calls 911, that it results in them getting shot 10 times? That makes no sense whatsoever. It's very much a flaky version of accountability on behalf of the police, because they're acting like they didn't mean to do it. But it doesn't make sense. Why did you even pull your gun in the first place? He was unarmed. See, if we're willing to put people in these situations that believe in human life, that believe in protecting the citizen too, then we might be able to possibly avoid 10 bullet wounds, you know, because of a 911 distress call, even though there was no danger. So, I mean, I don't want people to be so afraid of the words as much as the actions. You know, I just don't want to get shot 10 times, Stan. That's all. I don't want to call 911 and possibly get shot. Because I'm looking at the article, and I believe it to be true, not to say that that's every cop, but to say that why don't we hear enough good cops speaking about this? That's all. Thank you, Stan.
All right, brother. Appreciate you. Come on, Izzy. Izzy? I seen you flinching. And then see, right behind you.
I agree with the caller. We do need to, part of the conversation that needs to be had is pulling police action away from areas that they shouldn't be involved in or only involved in because the social services is completely collapsed underneath them. But I think that part of the problem with the conversation is we talk about getting them out of these areas, but then when it comes to putting something in to replace them, there's ideas, there's less conversation, but it needs to be, if we're going to pull police out of these areas, they need to be involved in the transition as well. But they do need to get pulled out of these areas. They don't, I mean, historically, especially when you talk about responding to mental health calls, they shouldn't be, because usually they exacerbate that situation more times than they solve it.
And that's probably true.
Yeah, you're frozen. We still hear you, though.
Yeah. But, I mean, one thing that I would say when it comes to why officers don't speak out about this, I mean, they do. You just don't hear about it a lot. And then also then they get tied up in litigation with their own departments for speaking out because there's an environment and a culture of retribution among police departments, and they go after them if you try and break ranks. And one of the things that bugs me about that whole, like, why aren't the good officers speaking out is that it kind of ignores the circumstances that they exist in speaking out. Mm-hmm. And that's, like, mm-hmm. a complete lack of protection. The idea that, and I've heard this before, like, people talk about, oh, you're worried about losing your job, you know, screw your job, you should be doing what's right. And while I don't necessarily disagree with that statement in the idealistic way that it's presented, it negates the other person's reality entirely. Like, you don't know why they're not speaking out, or you don't know why they're not being heard. And to just say, like, oh, you should just risk your entire career and everything that you're doing just for this, you know, because you should speak out about this, you should to a certain degree, but there should be protections to make it easier. And there should be a culture in police departments that make it easier. Officers shouldn't be scared to come forward. And the fact that we're not questioning why they're scared to come forward, we're just saying you need to come forward and say, speak out no matter what, you have to have a full conversation. There's a reason they're not speaking. You should be asking, why are they scared to speak up? Why do they feel threatened? And why shouldn't they be concerned about their careers and their jobs to a certain extent? And why aren't they protected? There needs to be more whistleblower protection. There needs to be more programs like EPIC, where intervention programs, where it's a culture where officers are going to step forward and stop each other from doing stuff like that. But I agree with the caller. They need to be pulled out, and you shouldn't be calling 911 and worried about getting shot. And in the conversation, I also agree that there is a little bit of that blame on the community when, in this conversation, both people need to come to the table, but police departments need to be making the first 5, 10, 15 steps.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not. We don't see that. Most departments, they have automatically closed ranks. They get defensive, and they do that. They say, like, well, what is the community doing? And it's like, no, in this conversation, police are kind of on the wrong side of things to a certain degree. And if you want to repair that bridge, you need to come forward as openly and as accountability focused as you possibly can. And you don't see enough of that, I think, is the problem.
Yeah, Joe.
No, you, Jim. You first.
Oh, okay. So, you know, and the caller, yeah, I get it. I understand. And in a sense, I know what he's trying to do, anything, you know, as far as the funding, he doesn't want the police department gone. He just wants different resources allocated to deal with specific types of calls. And you know what? If I could get rid of them, I would. The problem is the way we are is it's always going to come back to us anyway. I mean, if we're going out on barking dog calls, when a social services worker, if you have one available, because social services, as Jenny said, has collapsed, if you have one available, it goes to a mental health call, and they end up arming themselves, who are they going to call? We're going back out there anyway. So I think people need to be prepared for that conversation as to what calls are they going to go on, what calls are law enforcement going to go on. And that's easy to figure out. I get you know, and I go back to Dallas Chief David Brown, you know, and the Chicago Chief, after the shooting, he said that, you know, we're going out on all kinds of stuff that just, well, the police department will handle. Some of that is part of our problem. Some of that is brought upon us. We've taken those assignments,
mm-hmm.
and we need to tell them, no, we're not going anymore. I somewhat agree about the defunding. I don't agree with the defunding. But let me explain why I'm saying that. So
does defunding actually mean? Because that's
defunding is reallocating for service, not knocking out the PD, but changing things up. But the problem that I have specifically in my area, and I'm only going to talk about my areas. I can't talk about where Joe's at or Minneapolis or any of these insane places, but the social services and dealing with mental health, our resources are scarce. Even if they beef it up, they're still scarce. And Stan, you can attest to that. You're part of it. You were here. You know what it is.
Mm-hmm.
So I've got to implement a plan to beef up those services. Now, law enforcement can respond. I believe it was Denham again said, you know, we get all kinds of training in mental health.
Mm-hmm.
Now, some of us are not good at it, right? Some of us are good at it.
And so what we're going to develop, and again, I'm only talking about myself, is I'm going to develop a crisis intervention team based off of Houston PD to respond to mental health and put the people in place that are good at dealing with mental health. But I have the latitude to do that in my agency because I'm the boss and I can make that thing happen. Now, I'll have to have some extra funding as a result and training and whatnot, but I'll make that occur. But it's a resource that needs to be available. Now, when you start talking about Chicago PD, Minneapolis PD, that's a whole different ballgame. That's a completely different undertaking that their services dealing with those calls that we don't want law enforcement going on. Again, that goes back to having a community conversation. What are those calls going to be? I mean, cause look, if I can get rid of barking dog calls and code enforcement, then I'd do that in a heartbeat. If I can get rid of mental health and people get really do get help for mental health, man, I'd be on board. I've actually advocated for that long before we had this conversation about sending officers on mental health because they just don't get the help they need anyway. And we're not the best people to do it. Mm-hmm. I honestly know that. But, it's a conversation of what does the community want? Because, you know, I've had conversations with folks in my community, and when you start talking about defunding or allocating resource or money to other things, my community said, well, you got to need more money. So it's going to be different for every community, just like community policing is going to be different.
Well, that's one of the things that is kind of the misnomer when we have the money conversation. And one of the things that Joe's often brought up is that, like, we need to start auditing these departments.
Yes, yes.
Where the money – Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know what? I agree with that 100%. I mean, my budget's online. It'll tell you exactly. You go to our – and I think that's part of that transparency module. You can go to the city and look at the budget and see what's going where. Now, if we change something, and I'll be honest with you, if I have a line item change because I've decided instead of buying this piece of equipment, we want to buy this piece of equipment, then it's held in a public forum, such as the council meeting. So they're notified and it's on record that these things are changing. So I agree with that. If you're not looking at the budget, Stan has said that. I mean, I don't know how many times you said that, Stan. If you're not looking and asking what's in the budget,
mm-hmm.
then you're missing that piece. Where's that money going? So, you look at the training aspect and asking, well, what, I mean, because mine doesn't specifically say what training they're going to, but you come in, I'll tell you what training they're going to. It's on record with the state, so... That's a key point. That's 100% legit.
I mean, and also the one thing that bugs me also about the conversation when it comes to the money part of things is that we keep having this conversation of like all or nothing. Like it keeps being like, oh well, if we want these social services, we need to take all this money out of the police department. You know, if we want good police departments, we can't fund social services.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a fallacy. Like
You're 100% correct. I don't think there's any community that's represented or people that are on this, that may be watching this, that say they have 100% fantastic mental health system. I mean, it doesn't exist. It doesn't exist. So, you know, and if it did exist, we would not go on these repeat calls and people would be getting the help that they need.
Right.
Yeah.
And I mean, the side of things is that in the conversation of, oh, we're going to just put money into these social services, it's just like, okay, are you auditing those social services? Because you
right.
can't invest into social services right now. I someone did an article the other day that talked about the fact that it just came out that the foster care system has been skimming millions of dollars
mm-hmm.
from Social Security for the kids in the foster care system.
I'm not surprised.
So you look at the social working system and all the problems that happen with that. I mean, it's just like this is what we're just going to blindly put money into, and you're not going to watch them. Like, there's this illusion in the narrative that, like, policing is terrible, but all of these social services that have been neglected and have received no funding for decades are somehow on the sidelines. They're doing great.
But
if we just give them this, they're gonna fix everything.
You know, Joe, before I go to you, I got to say this, but when I hear this defund the police, this is what bothers me with that term, is I look at the communities, the poor communities, some of them that I worked in, the city didn't give resources to them. They didn't have sidewalks. The grass looked like trees. Yet we did it with chainsaws. And the city didn't give a damn until investors came. So when I hear defunding, people need to understand, when you pull that money out of the police budget, I don't know about everywhere, It doesn't magically sit in the police department savings account. It goes back to what cities call a general fund. And they take that money and go over to this area and prune or invest it over in this development. And guess what? You still don't have sidewalks. And then when you say, we don't have a power program, you know what they tell you? Submit something to the city and we'll look at it next fiscal year. So we're not taking that money and leaving it in the police department. That money is coming out. Anytime you start talking about defunding and cutting back in police departments, I'm going to tell you, I get Joe, if I'm lying, tell me I'm wrong. The first people that suffer as a consequence to that money that's coming out of departments are the people in the areas that need the police the most. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Joe.
I just find it something funny. I think the caller's point was disingenuous at best. I mean, he claims to have been in the military. Let's talk about decisions made in the military, decisions made in the police department. Basically the same idea. But let me really put this back to a very basic point. Who cut the funding for the social programs? An elected official.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go back to a very basic point. Elected official who you did or did not vote for.
Mm-hmm.
So let's get back to some real basics, some homegrown ass-kicking basics. If you don't vote, this is what you get. But let me throw this at you. Let me throw this at you. The biggest scam perpetrated on the people in this United States right now is this thing called a TIF fund.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you think I'm lying, sit back and get in the car with Joe for a minute. A TIF fund is where they take money already allocated from your tax dollars and tax you again. Now get that straight. You get taxed twice, and you don't know where the second half of the money is going. So you want to know where your social services are? Go ask those guys you elected. Quit bitching about some stuff that you have a duty
mm-hmm.
to understand. Now, the other issue I have is this. Mike brought it up earlier in the chief, and all of us agree. You want to educate the police, and I get that. No problem, because we're the ones out there. Educate the public as well. There's a duty, a fiduciary relationship that's created by the very nature that we serve you. You have to know about us, too. We got to know about you, right? We got to know about you. You got to know about us. Learn where the money is. You want to find out where the money is? Read the budget.
Follow the money. Let me do this real quick. Let me jump down 314, call it 314 area code 4953. Good morning.
You know, Stan, you were talking about grass and sidewalks. Areas like that come under the Community Development Block Grant Fund. And in general, a county will have a public meeting where ideas and suggestions on what areas those funds should be spent. Now, if the communities that you're talking about, if they aren't present there at that meeting, then they're either going to get what someone else want to allocate to them or what's left over. And it goes back to your leadership. A lot of the leadership that represent these areas that you just got through mentioning, frankly, is not worth a damn. Because if they were, then the conversation wouldn't be going as they are. So I just want to put that in there. CDGD, Community Development Block Grant Funds, are designed to address those areas of concern you made mention of. Thank you.
All right, brother. Appreciate you. 203 area code 0263. Good morning. Going once. All right, we'll leave that mic open. Joe, Izzy, Keith, we'll get back to y'all. Had to get there. I'm trying to get these callers in as they go.
I think needs to be had in the conversation more is that police departments and policing involvement in certain areas, they do need to be shrunk. I think that's one of the conversations that everybody can agree on, including police officers, because they don't want to be responding to a lot of these calls. Like, we need to have that conversation more. They do need to be pulled out of them. The problem is that, much like always in the topic of policing or in general, we're having isolated conversations about specific things. And as the chief said, everything affects everything. So, like, I mean, who you vote for will affect it. Your city manager is going to affect it. Police training is going to affect it. Their hiring and recruitment is going to affect it. how the federal government spends their money and what they allocate to states is going to affect it. And we're not having a large conversation about how all of these things affect one another. We're having specific itemized conversations that in certain ways I think do a disservice to any idea of reform, because when you're just talking about blind cuts in funding or blind improvements to training or blind diversity increasing, it doesn't acknowledge all the problems that exist.
I think it's go ahead, Gene.
I was going to say, not only that, I said this last week, you know, with the lieutenant that was stopped by those officers, you know, that whole mess, you know, the governor's going to invite them to talk. He's going to invite that lieutenant. They're going to have a conversation. Why are we still having conversations? Why is there not actually doing something about it?
Right.
I would love to be in a position to get something done, but I'm not an elected official. I don't make law. I mean, I'm in a different status, but I mean, these elected folks need to get moving. I mean, and part of the problem is that I don't know who they're talking to, but you know, as I think everybody in this panel has said in the past, some of the things that they're trying to pass as far as what they consider reform are ridiculous. They're things that that agencies are already doing, and it doesn't have any teeth. There's nothing to it. So I don't know where these conversations with these elected folks are coming, but they need to get off and start doing something.
Okay, Chief, here's a step forward. How about the federal government stop introducing these grants and the states, particularly the state of Texas, introducing these grants to police departments that are strapped for funds, whether it's financial irresponsibility or rising crime for whatever reason. These grant programs are all statistic-based. They got jack to do with public safety. Let's get real about it, okay?
Well, and you're 100% correct. But I can't get a grant.
Yeah, but I mean, they want to have seatbelt step program, speed step program. Guess what? Guess where those officers go? They go to the poor communities, and you have to write X amount of tickets an hour. It's a quota, and you got to do it. And you know what? And that's to meet that grant. So you're victimizing that community out there for a grant, and then from the officers, personnel, everything is so statistically driven that we don't see these people out here as citizens anymore. We don't see them as human beings. We see them as statistics that politicians use to pay to get more grants, for these chiefs use to get accreditations and to get all that because, look, I'm the chief, I look good, and I'm going to move to the next department. And the officers who are busting their ass and having to deal with these victims live with the nightmares. And the citizens have to deal not just with the financial strapping, in and out of jail. I've lost my job. Why? Because we have to produce statistics to meet the grant that Stan didn't ask for, Joe didn't ask for, the chief asked for.
Not this chief.
There's a factor that you all are missing. The grant game is another game in itself. Because if you don't get in, if you don't know when the RFP is issued, now remember I've read grants, and the chief will tell you, if you don't know when that RFP is issued, you may never be in line to even get it.
Yeah, exactly.
So, yeah.
But you said
gamesmanship.
Right, but if they're selling their soul and the souls of the citizens and the citizens' safety and their quality of life and their financial security for the purpose of sustaining a bullshit grant that now produces hardship in some household somewhere that now produces a criminal, but we produce the statistic, so it's okay. That's the garbage.
And even to your statistical point, for UCR, IVR data, you use a federal government, I won't call them out, but you use a federal government grant for officer staffing.
Mm-hmm.
Like a community that I work in, I can't get because I don't have the crime statistics.
You know what I mean?
That's a good thing for me that I don't have crime.
Right, but you're punished for having a safe fit. You're punished.
But if I implement a program, so like I use this as an example. I applied for this specific federal grant, and I thought, you know, I got to be different because I know I don't have the crime, and I know that's a major factor. But why don't we do something a little different? So I decided to try to turn it into an addition to our school resource officer program based on the 21st century policing model that came out under the Obama administration. And I tied it in, and I see Joe laughing, but it was beautiful. The day was beautiful. And I got, hey, that's a great idea. We don't have any funding for you. So we got X amount of officers going here. I get it. But it was an awesome grant, and it was different than anything else. And I thought, well, maybe, because I actually did get a call from that three-letter federal agency, BGA, that said, hey, that was a really good grant. That's a great idea. But it doesn't meet the criteria. So even trying to implement a new progressive type program in that essence, I just don't have the numbers. But Joe's right. It's a game.
Right.
It's gamemanship. And even today, the grants, and I don't know about the other states, but the local grants even here are pitiful. I mean, there's no money anyway. So, and there's agencies that are minimal, small agencies, 3-4 officer agencies, and they're driving old junkie 200, 300, 400,000 miles.
We reward the bad police departments. This country, you know, the government rewards the bad ones can get money. You know, yeah. When I went into neighborhoods, there are three types of neighborhoods you're going to have in any city. You got your safe zone, that's your gated community, zero crime, everything's great. You have your transitional neighborhood, which is you got your good area, but you got your bad area, and it flips it back. And then you got your lost zone. The lost zone is just, it's going to need major repair. So you go into that transitional neighborhood and shore that up, because the transitional neighborhood, if the neighborhood is your transitional police departments, you give them resources because they reinforce your great neighborhood and they have a visual effect on the lost zone. And it's the same with police departments. The federal government dumps so much money into these big police departments that are failures. Not the men and women there, but the administration is a failure, monumentally. And so departments like yours doing the right thing can't get that money. So you don't get any reward for being good.
Yeah, you're right. I want to speak on what you said about the three types of neighborhoods. It should be the opposite. That money should go into that, I guess, whatever would be the socioeconomically depressed neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
That's where the money should go, to build that up and work the other way around.
Right.
Not the transitional, not the big one. But I'm crazy, but even in law enforcement, that's where, and this is not an enforcement action, but this idea of what we're talking about, the new look of policing, that's what a lot of people call a new look of policing. I just call it policing because it's what I've been doing. In my mantra, in my mind, but that's where these ideas need to be put into place in those areas there. That's where it needs to go. We provide services to the entire community, but the connections need to be made in the area that the people are on somewhat shaky ground with law enforcement.
Mm-hmm.
That's where those connections need to be made.
So, are you telling me then that the whole idea of community policing should be funded nationally? Oh, but it's an unfunded mandate, but let's do that.
It is absolutely 100% unfunded. Every community policing events, idea, anything that has to do with community policing comes from within my department, within the confines of my budget. Nothing else. And as a matter of fact, just to be honest, as we were talking about the budget, the line items that I do have, and I can still tell you the kind of difference in the people that we've got. The line items that support the community policing aspect are minimal, probably under $7,000 for the three line items I have, which provide food for people at our Citizens Police Academy, that provide stuff for the cops with the cop, and our National Night Out budget.
The
$3.3 million budget is what I control.
But I think...
So the rest of it is just us.
It's out of your officer's pocket.
Exactly, Joe. Community policing is funded today. It's funded by the individual officers reaching in their pockets, away from the cameras, buying the groceries. Exactly.
But again, that's why I talk about the whole idea of hypocrisy. I mean, you tell these officers, oh, go out and do a great job. Oh, engage the community.
Mm-hmm.
Give them no resources.
Exactly.
In Chicago, when they eliminated, they closed all the mental health clinics and then put the calls on the police and said, oh, we got a problem. Yeah, we got a problem. We got homeless vets, which in my mind should never happen. We've got
homeless people, I mean, actors standing in the middle of the street dancing. I mean, I can't make it up.
Let's do this. In the 30-minute mark we got right now, let's go around it and let's each nail down. What is the thing we think we want to see change? That if we could go in and just change one aspect of policing that would lead to the reform that we as an individual want to see, what would it be? And anybody can start. In fact, I'll tell you how we'll start. We'll go up here to 804. We'll get Big Gus first because we want to always acknowledge the callers. Gus, about 30 seconds.
What I want to see happen, and I think it would be really beneficial, is to start off with holding people accountable for their misdeeds and their misconduct, and a national registry for the people who do those misdeeds.
All right, brother. Appreciate you. Let me go down. Rob, 30 seconds. Something you want to see change.
I appreciate you having me on this platform, Stan. All I want to see changed is I want to stop seeing money go into police unions' pockets, and I want to start seeing it going to those poor communities that y'all were talking about earlier.
All right, brother, appreciate you. Tyrell K. Dunmore, about 30 seconds. We're coming back to you. You there? All right, Chief, what would you like to see changed?
We only have 30 minutes, Dan. there's so much. I go back to a lot of places that are doing it right, because if they weren't doing it right, we'd all be in the news. So I want to start there. So why don't we look and find out some of these agencies why they're doing it better than everybody else? Let's begin there. Anything I think that I've ever come up with that I believe is good and has helped and impacted the community, I stole from some other department. I have a few things that were my own, but I borrow. I guess in the better terms, not the law, since I'm law enforcement, I borrow from other agencies and try to implement it into our community. And if it works, that's great. If it doesn't work, we scrap it. We start back over again. I think that some of the big things like recruiting, diversity, trying, and again, it's difficult. And I saw a comment of why don't agencies look more reflective of their communities, and I truly believe that that's important. Ours is, I think, actually in our county, I think we're the closest in demographics in our department to the populace that we serve. I think it's important. The problem is that recruitment. Who wants to be a cop now? So it becomes difficult to find individuals that want to do this job. I think, though, if you have a good agency, you've got good policies in place, you've got good leadership, it makes it easier to get people on board to come work for your department that are interested in service to the community. And, again, that's really what it's about. I think that we need to really push empathy among our personnel, and I think that we need to talk about this guardianship that we're guardians of the community. We're not, we're there to help and serve the community. We're the guardians of the community. Whether it's dealing with major crime, or buying somebody groceries, or whatever it may be, but it's got to be that all well-rounded aspect, and that needs to be pushed down to people and hiring the right people in place. We get it right sometimes. Sometimes we get it wrong. But it goes back to, I believe you said it was Gus, holding those people accountable. So if they mess something up, they've got to go. I'm fortunate I don't have a police union. I have a police association. But they're like me. If we get along, we're working for the common good. I mean, yeah, they want some certain. Like they might want some piece of equipment, and if it's applicable to our department, we'll try to get it. But there's not a fight. There's not a fight. I try to make it that way, and make it to where that accountability is still there. I mean, they know that it's there, and I'm going to hold them to a high standard, and they'll pay the price if need be. But that's a huge question. I wish somebody in the government would come contact me because I've got a lot of cool ideas, I think.
Be careful what you ask for.
Hey, you know, but I mean, but you guys, and if you do, you, I don't know who they're discussing this stuff with, but a lot of it, it makes me scratch my head, and I think, why? Who are you discussing this reform issue with, and where do they come from? You know, I'm not going to talk to a doctor about a medical procedure because I don't know anything about being a doctor or being a surgeon. You know, I mean, I can learn. But, you know, again, why are we not finding these people? Why are we not finding the Joe Mosleys? Why is somebody not grabbing him up and saying, hey, look, you've done this for a long time. You've been at a major agency. What do you think needs to happen? How would you deal with these issues? I mean, he's a law enforcement badass. I hate to say it. I said it about him. But he is. I mean, he's knowledgeable. He knows what's going on.
Aquarius. Libra. Leo. Cancer.
These are some of the ideas that we've got. You know, I just think that if they're going to reach out for, and I'm saying some major agency, I'm not going to call on names, but they're the ones that are in the news that are not doing it right. So, you know, again, it just makes me scratch my head. But, I mean, again, there's a whole bunch of stuff. Biggest thing is anybody may be listening, go to your local department. Get to know your agency. Be part of the community. And if you do that, then you can be part of solving this problem.
All right. Izzy.
I mean, I agree with everything the chief said, but that one caller said, I'd say we need to increase transparency and accountability. We need to make sure that these police departments are being open and honest when things do happen and are punishing the people involved if they need to be punished. I think we need to shift the conversation a little bit and start addressing the issue of culture more often. You hear less about culture conversations and more about small band-aid type solutions. The main problem is culture of policing and the culture of justice in this country. I think we need to start shifting more and understanding that we need less punitive and more restorative and reformative justice practices. I think one of those, in the vein of that, is pulling police out of these areas that they shouldn't be in and don't want to be in. I think we should be pulling them out of mental health calls. I think they shouldn't be responding to homelessness, to a lot of the drug stuff, prostitution, stuff like that. And I think the statistics and the research shows that they arguably do a little bit more harm than good in those areas when they are responding to them because they don't have the resources, they don't have the training. And I think in that vein also that if we are going to be pulling police out of these areas, we need to make sure that there is incentivizing happening for both police departments and for the social services to be making that shift and that they have the funding to make sure that if that shift happens, it's done smoothly and well and continuously. Because as I've said before, you can take the money out of it and put it into something else, but if you aren't monitoring that and that isn't continuous funding, you're not fixing anything. So I think that needs to be something that needs to happen. And I think that we need to, in the conversation, do a lot more to humanize everyone in the conversation. I think that the fact that we don't consider environmental effects on everyone involved, and that includes police officers, that includes civilians, that includes everybody, is a big problem. Too much of the conversation has happened, black or white, very strict context, and I don't think it's fair to dehumanize anyone when we're talking about this. And I think it's very interesting how quickly people can condemn police in general because of the actions of the few, and it is actions of the few. I know everybody hates to hear that. But there's 18,000 departments. There's like almost 500,000 police officers in the country. Like it's not all of them. And to dehumanize all of them is to negate the real difficulties of the job, because it is a hard job. It is a dangerous job. And then in that sense, I think we need to change the narrative of what we think policing is in this country. And I think when it comes to hiring and recruitment, we need to change what people think policing is. We need to get out of this militarized mindset. We need to get back into the service mindset, into the garden mindset that the chief said, because departments are still advertising the job like it's an action movie. And I think as long as you're doing that, you're not changing it.
All right, brother. I'm going to get mine real quick before I let Joe take us out. And I'm just going to be quick. If I could wave a wand and have some things change or be gone, the first thing I'd want is whistleblower protection for all state, city, county, and municipal officers on par with what the feds have. The second one I'd like to have is ongoing mental health treatment, mental health services, and a meaningful and dedicated suicide prevention in place for all retired, active, and officers who have had to resign due to injury in place. I'd like to see the good old boys taken out of policing. I'd like to see the racists taken out of policing. And I'd like to see the political parties and opinions within the departments that seem to construct the underlining of the department. I'd like to see politics taking out as far as in the department decision-making process, get it out. You know, because I think when we get into as a department where you go out and enforce your political will upon people, that's the same as going out and enforcing your religious will on people. So we need to get rid of political Sharia, religious Sharia, and we need to get back to serving the community, meeting them where they are in their condition, not the lens by which you choose to view their condition. And with that, Joe, take us out.
I don't know if I can follow all that Sharia stuff there, son.
You got it. You can do it. Don't make me play the sound bite.
let me say this. Again, let's start with a very basic topic. Let's talk about the grants issue. Understand that people have a misconception when it comes to police funding and grant writing. When the grants are made available, they all go to a state agency, which the departments then have to go and petition. We can't go to the government itself. Most people think, you can go to DOH and get your money. No, that's not how it happens. DOH passes the money down to the state, then we have to go to the state. Now, if you're not in that game, if you're not in the good old boy club, you won't get what's called the RFP, the request for a proposal. So problem one. The other issue that I'd like to see, and I've said it and I will continue to say it, is the promotional process. Jim, tell me if I'm wrong. You've seen, you know that it's the fact that you put the same people in place who are the sons and daughters. We have an operation here called Special Operations. We call it SOS, Sons of Supervisors. You couldn't get in it if your father hadn't been a big wig or whatever else. Even though the department says if you work your hunger's off, you get rewarded. Well, that's just not the case. So let's just get that out. But let me go back and be very clear about that. We have this thing called the theoreticians. The theoreticians usually hand the idea to the politician, who then enacts it into law, and then we're the end user of it. So if you want to know what the problem is, look at the theoretician. And again, the number one concern for me is those politicians. Because when they eliminate something from a budget, who does it? An elected official. Not the police. Not the social service agency. It's that elected official. So you can lay the blame a lot of this at the feet of those people that you say look like you and represent you, but don't. They do you more harm than good. So let's be very clear on those issues. But if I could do anything right away, I think we have to bring back common sense. That's for me. I mean, I work with a guy, his name, I can say it like that. His name was William Kidd, Billy the Kid. He didn't even wear a gun. I walked into him one day, I'm a young recruit. I got an S on my chest, a Superman. I said, Mr. Kidd, where's your gun? He said, son, I don't need one. But I'm not locking nobody down. He had the most dangerous beating in the district. He walked around with no gun on. They love this guy. And he was so crazy. If he said be at the station, he was like 200 feet. Read the story. If he told you to be at the station, you know these guys would actually walk to the station? Now that's power. Now I had two guns. I had two guns. And I had to fight people. This guy had no gun. And talked to him, I'm going to see Mr. Kidd. I got to get locked up. What are we going on here? him up. So that's what I would do. I mean, if I could clone that guy, bring back the common sense. And I will say this, the biggest problem we have in this country, in this world, is ignorance. Because ignorance makes you hate, makes you dislike, makes you dishonest things. I dislike broccoli. I didn't hate nobody. And I'll leave it at that.
Well, I definitely want to thank the caller, Brandon, that called in earlier and shared, Rob, Gus, Big 804, everybody. It's called it Izzy, the Chief Joe. I appreciate you guys. Every Saturday you're here, and we have these hard discussions, and we have, these hard topics to Facebook people that take time out from on a Saturday morning, and they take time out and watch the show. And I mean, if you guys think the show is something, you ought to go back and read the comments. The Facebook Live comments, that's a whole nother show right there. So if you're in the media, don't focus sometime on me, Joe, or the Chief, or Tony, or whoever's here. Go read the comments, because there's people putting some strong stuff in those comments that's real 100% fact. So I love all the people that take time out, Doc Rich, Mike Denham, G, Steven, and everybody else that's on there. And I'm just blessed, that we can do this every Saturday. And if you're on the Facebook and something that you think is a good topic and it's something you want to bring up, it's like I said, you shoot me a message or shoot Joe a message, and we'll do the show. We'll do it. But guess what? You're going to host it, and you ain't going to do, I'm going to be on the timeline. You're going to be on the Zoom. If it's this is where you get a voice. This is where you get to be somebody. So if you something's important to you, I don't care if you're in Waco or Los Angeles. If it's that important to you, it's important to somebody else. And this is where you can come and actually let the world know what you think. Because it's a sad dog that won't wag its own tail. And I appreciate everybody for being here. We're going to get ready to get out. Ed, boy, you did good today. You only got cut off one.
Oh, my Wi-Fi held together today.
I know it, man. Wow.
Yeah.
You're having your plug that smart toaster, everything starts working.
Yeah, right.
No, I'm serious, bro. I found out when I started turning off TVs and different things, my connection would pick up too. So it's amazing how much stuff we got that's eating up our bandwidth. But
thanks,
thanks to everybody.
Turn everything off here. It still goes down. There's too many people on the Wi-Fi.
Yeah, Chief. I see that shovel in the background. You gonna use that later?
Yeah, I gotta get out of my garden over here. I'm looking at it like mess over there. So I got some stuff I'm gonna plant. Maybe I'm gonna be a farmer today here in Waco or in Texas.
Yeah, okay. You got one of those hats with the cans and the little straw that comes down while you're out there hacking the weeds?
No, I'll put on some baseball cap. I don't have that little
thing. Well, NASCAR cup holders.
No, I don't need one of those. I hold my beer in my hand.
There you go.
That's where I'm.
And once again, congratulations, Reverend Frank Montgomery. That was my mentor down there in Waco, stood in my corner. But we're going to get out. Appreciate everybody. Love you guys. Thanks for being here. Atlanta, Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, Waco, Texas. Joe, you can shout out Chicago. Keith, you can shout Hewitt.
33rd
state
in the city
instead
of Texas.
Hey, take a minute, Chief. Boost that, baby. No, man. Take about 30 seconds. Talk. Let the people know that. That's good.
They put out some of these. We've gotten several times. It's just a company called SafeWise, or it's a group called SafeWise, and they rank Texas cities on safety based on UCR, income, affordable housing, all kinds of metrics that they decide. I don't know how many cities there are in Texas, but we're 33rd. That's
33.
That's 33. Yeah. 34. We're the dump. They ranked, I think it's 279 communities from first to last. And we're in that top quarter.
percent one of the safest communities. And something for I'm proud of it. My people are the ones that make the difference. It's a whole group effort, not me. But it's my hopes and the city itself making things better. There's a lot of great places in Texas that are way higher than us, and I know those communities. Again, those are the folks that I borrow stuff from. It's a pretty good accolade for us, and I'm very proud of my folks, and it's because of them that we are where we are.
All right, and shout out to my granddaughter. You know, she's 5 years old right now, and with that construction going on Interstate 35, by the time she graduates high school, she should be able to see them cut the ribbon and open up the roads again, as slow as they do construction here. But anyway, appreciate everybody. We're going to get out. Love you guys. Everybody be safe. Stay masked up. Rona's real. Life is not a Trump rally. And we're up.
See you guys.
See ya.